to get into Building 31 than Julian would have supposed. Its main defenses were against military attack and mob assault. It didn't even have a burglar alarm. Of course, she first would have to get onto the base. They sent descriptions of her in the two modes they knew of, and copies of her fingerprints and retina scans to the gate, with strict detention orders, armed and dangerous. There were no security cameras in the Guadalajara airport, but there were plenty at Portobello. No one who looked like her had gotten off any of the 6 flights arriving from Mexico that afternoon and evening. But that could just mean a third disguise. There were a few women her size and shape. Their descriptions also went to the gate. In fact, as Jefferson might have predicted, in her paranoia, Gavrilla bought a ticket to Portobello, but didn't use it. Instead, she flew to the canal zone disguised as a man. She went down to the waterfront and found a drunken soldier who resembled her, and killed him for his papers and uniform. She left most of the body in a hotel room, first cutting off the hands and head, wrapping them well, and mailing them at the cheapest rate to a fictitious address in Bolivia. She took the monorail to Portobello, and was inside the base an hour before they started looking for her. She didn't have her plastic gun and knife, of course. She'd even left behind the scalpel she'd used on Ellie. There were thousands of weapons inside the base, but all were locked up and accounted for, except for a few guards and MPs with pistols. Killing an MP sounded like a bad way to get a weapon. She went down to the armory and loitered for a while, inspecting it, while appearing to read the notices on the bulletin board, then waiting in line for a few minutes and rushing off as if she'd forgotten something. She went back outside the building and then re-entered through a back door. From the floor plan she'd memorized, she went straight to routine maintenance. There was a duty roster posted. She went to an adjacent room and called the specialist on maintenance duty and told him a Major Feldman wanted to see him at the desk. He left the room unlocked, and Gavrilla slipped in. She had perhaps 90 seconds. Find something lethal that looked like it worked and wouldn't be missed immediately. There was a jumbled pile of M-31s, mud-splattered but otherwise in good shape, probably used in an exercise by officers who wouldn't be expected to clean them afterward. She picked one and wrapped it in a green towel, along with a cassette of exploding darts and a bayonet. Poison darts would have been better, quieter, but there weren't any in the open stock. She slipped outside undetected. This didn't appear to be the kind of base where a soldier could casually carry a light assault weapon around, so she kept the M-31 wrapped up. She put the sheathed bayonet inside her belt, under her shirt. The binding that compressed her breasts was uncomfortable, but she left it on in case it would buy her an extra second or two of surprise. The uniform was loose, and she looked like a slightly chubby man, short, with a barrel chest. She walked carefully. Building 31 looked no different from the ones that surrounded it, except for a low electrified fence and a sentry box. She walked by the box in the dusk, fighting the temptation to rush the shoe guard and shoot her way in. She could do some real damage with the 40 rounds in the cassette, but she knew from Jefferson that there would be soldier boy guards on duty. The black man Julian's platoon. Julian Class. Dr. Jefferson hadn't known anything about the building's floor plan, though, which was what she needed now. If she knew where Harding was, she could create a diversion for the soldier boys as far as possible from her quarry, and then go after her. But the building was too large to just go in cold and hope to find her while the soldier boys were occupied for a few minutes. They would be expecting her too, of course. She didn't look at Building 31 as she walked by. They certainly knew about the torture murders. Was there any way she could use that knowledge against them, make them careless through fear? Whatever action she took, it would have to be within the building. Otherwise, outside forces would deal with it, while Harding was protected by the soldier boys. She stopped dead, and then forced herself to move on. That was it. Create a diversion outside, but be inside when they find out about it. Follow the soldier boys to her prey. Then she would need God's help. The soldier boys would be swift, though probably pacified, if the humanizing scheme had worked. She had to kill Harding before they restrained her. But she was all confidence. The Lord had gotten her this far. He would not fail her now. Even the woman's name, Blaze, was demonic, as well as her mission. Everything was right. She turned the corner and said a quiet prayer. A child was playing alone on the sidewalk. A gift from the Lord. We were lying in bed talking when the console chimed its phone signal. It was Marty. He was weary but smiling.
"They called me out of surgery," he said. "Good news for a change, from Washington. They did a segment on your theory on the Harold Burley Hour tonight."
"Supporting it?" Amelia said.
"Evidently. I just saw a minute of it, back to work. It should be linked to your data queue by now. Take a look."
He punched off, and we found the program immediately. It started out with an optical of a galaxy exploding dramatically, sound effects and all. Then the profile of Burley, serious as usual, faded in, looking down on the cataclysm.
"Could this be us, only a month from now? Controversy rages in the highest scientific circles, and not only scientists have questions. The police do, too."
A still picture of Peter, bedraggled and forlorn, naked from the waist up, holding a number for the police camera.
"This is Peter Blankenship, who for two decades has been one of the most highly regarded cosmologists in the world. Today, he doesn't even know the right number of planets in the solar system. He thinks he's living in the year 2004, and is confused to be a 20-year-old man in a 64-year-old body. Someone jacked him and extracted all his past back to that year. Why? What did he know? Here is Simone Mallett, head of the FBI's Forensic Neuropathology Unit."
A woman in a white coat with a jumble of gleaming equipment behind her.
"Dr. Mallett, what can you tell us about the level of surgical technique used on this man?"
"The person who did this belongs in jail," she said. "Subtle equipment was used or misused. Microscopic AI-directed investigation shows that they initially tried to erase specific, fairly recent memories, but they failed repeatedly and finally erased one huge block with a surge of power. It was the murder of a personality, and we know now, the destruction of a great mind."
Beside me, Amelia sighed, almost a sob, but leaned forward, studying the console intently. Burley peered directly out of the screen.
"Peter Blankenship did know something, or at least believed something, that profoundly affects you and me. He believed that unless we take action to stop it, the world will come to an end on September 14th.
There was a picture of the multiple mirror array on the far side of the moon, irrelevant to anything, tracking ponderously. Then a time-lapse shot of Jupiter rotating.
"The Jupiter Project, the largest, most complex scientific experiment ever conducted. Peter Blankenship had calculations that showed it had to be stopped, but then he disappeared and came back in no shape to testify about anything scientific. but his assistant, Professor Blaze Harding, an inset of Amelia lecturing, suspected foul play and herself disappeared. From a hiding place in Mexico, she sent dozens of copies of Blankenship's theory and the high, hard mathematics behind it to scientists all over the world. Opinions are divided. Back in his studio, Burley faced two men, one of them familiar.
"God, not Macro," Amelia said.
"I have with me tonight Professors Lloyd Daugherty and Mac Roman. Dr. Daugherty is a longtime associate of Peter Blankenship. Dr. Roman is the Dean of Sciences at the University of Texas, where Professor Harding works and teaches."
"Teaching isn't work," I said, and she shushed me. Macro settled back with a familiar, self-satisfied expression.
"Professor Harding has been under a great deal of strain recently, including a love affair with one of her students, as well as one with Peter Blankenship."
"Stick to the science, Macro," Daugherty said. "You've read the paper. What do you think of it?"
"Why, it's utterly fantastic. Ridiculous."
"Tell me why."
"Lloyd, the audience could never understand the mathematics involved, but the idea is absurd on the face of it. That the physical conditions that obtain inside something smaller than a BB could bring about the end of the universe."
"People said it was absurd to think that a tiny germ could bring about the death of a human being."
"That's a false analogy." His ruddy face got darker.
"No, it's precise. But I agree with you about it not destroying the universe."
Macro gestured at Burley and the camera. "Well, then," Daugherty continued,
"it would only destroy the solar system, perhaps the galaxy, a relatively small corner of the universe."
"But it would destroy the Earth," Burley said.
"In less than an hour, yes."
The camera came in close on him.
"There's no doubt about that."
"But there is," Macro said off-camera. Daugherty gave him a weary look.
"Even if the doubt were reasonable, and it is not, what sort of odds would be acceptable? A 50-50 chance? 10%? One chance in 100 that everyone would die?"
"Science doesn't work like that. Things aren't 10% true."
"And people aren't 10% dead, either."
Daugherty turned to Burley.
"The problem I found isn't with the first few minutes or even millenniums of the prediction. I just think they've made an error extrapolating into intergalactic space."
"Do tell," Burley said.
"Ultimately, the result would just be twice as much matter, twice as many galaxies. There's room for them."
"If one part of the theory is wrong," Macro began.
"Furthermore," Daugherty continued, "it looks as if this has happened before in other galaxies. It actually clears up some anomalies here and there."
"Getting back to Earth," Burley said, "or at least to this solar system, how big a job would it be to stop the Jupiter Project, the largest experiment ever set up?"
"Nothing to it in terms of science. Just one radio signal from JPL. Getting people to send a signal that will end their careers in science, that would normally be hard. But everybody's career ends September 14th if they don't."
"It's still irresponsible nonsense," Macro said. "Bad science. Sensationalism."
"You have about 10 days to prove that, Mac. A long line is forming behind that button."
Close up on Burley, shaking his head. "They can't turn it off too soon for me." The console went dead. We laughed and hugged and split a ginger ale in celebration. But then the screen chimed and turned itself on without my hitting the answer button. It was the face of Eileen Zakim, my new platoon leader.
"Julian, we have a real situation. Are you armed?"
"No. Well,
Yes, there's a pistol here. But it had been left behind.